Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show by deities for my patrons.
Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show by deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm studying the myths and religions of the world and looking for the inspiration we can find in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the myths and legends of Hawaii. And today we're going to be looking at something that I don't think really falls within the category of religion or myth, but I didn't really know where else to put it. And it's one of the most famous aspects of Hawaiian. It's not even mo'olelo. It's something else, but of Hawaiian folklore, and that is the menehune. So we're going to talk about the menehune and what they can suggest for things that we might include in games. Mind you, the menehune are actually pretty simple. You know, I was initially expecting to have this be a much more complicated episode, but the menehune surprised me a little bit. Anyway, let's take a look at them. The menehune are more creatures of folklore than mythology. We did see them in some of the kupua legends that we talked about in the previous episode, but it wasn't in a context that made them seem sacred. I'm aware that the distinctions between myth and legend and folklore are, you know, not hard and fast, right? They're just interpretations that we place on these things. I don't know that I necessarily have very clear differences. I remember being told that a myth was a sacred story about how the world came to be in its present state, but that actually excludes quite a lot of the things that we would traditionally think of as myths, at least as I would understand it. So, you know, perhaps that's not right. This is one of those things that only I really worry about, isn't it? That, you know, nobody but me cares whether this is in the right podcast category. It just seems like a funny week. We're kind of talking about a monster on Patron Deities, and the next episode of Monster Man is really going to be about mythology. So, anyway, whatever. The menehune are sort of the little people of Hawaiian folklore, and they do the kinds of things that we're accustomed to seeing little people do in European folklore. Specifically, they're makers and doers. They build large structures, specifically things like large walls or heiau. That's sort of temples, which are often on kind of big temple platform foundations, or fish ponds. A note about fish ponds. You might think that a fish pond is just like a pond that has some fish in it, but actually, creating fish ponds in a way where you can, like, efficiently breed and harvest fish from them is complex, and Hawaiian kind of pre-colonial society was very good at it. Hawaiian fish ponds are a whole complicated system of aquaculture with lots of different kinds of pond, which have specific features that make them good for, you know, raising different kinds of fish. And these are actually often combined agriculturally. So for instance, if you're cultivating kalo or taro, a lot of the time that's going to be in kind of like a wet agriculture environment, you know, so they'll be in shallow water. You can combine that with a fish pond, which actually has benefits both for the fish and for the taro. And that's a kind of Hawaiian fish pond that you would see more characteristically in an inland area, but there are also lots of like coastal and lagoon fish ponds, and they have their own particular features. One of the things that I learned while looking at different Hawaiian fish ponds is that in some places, I mean, so like fish ponds in other parts of the world, they often have systems of gates. So basically gates into the pond that allow passage only one way so that a fish can enter the pond from a larger body of water, but can't leave it again. And the walls that kind of created these gaps where the gates would sometimes be made from very porous volcanic rock. And so what that meant was that, like, by tidal action or whatever, water could come in and out of the fish pond, keeping it full of micronutrients or whatever, you know, keeping the water fresh. I mean, not fresh because it would often be salt or brackish water, but you know what I mean. But keeping the water supply replenished without the fish being able to leave. So they are pretty sophisticated systems, and one of those things where actually quite a complex system of sort of land and water management can seem like, you know, this is a really interesting thing. When you look at colonial writing about Hawaii, sorry, this is a sidetrack, but there is this constant desire to call Hawaiians lazy and say that they're like, oh, they're, you know, peaceful people, they're good natured, but they're not like hardworking and they're not aggressive and they don't have all these other qualities that Europeans have. And this is attributed to how, like, beneficial the climate is. This is a fruitful land full of good things to eat and like it doesn't have dangerous weather. My guy, it has volcanoes. But you know what I mean? Like, anyway, they ignored all that stuff. The idea being that the natural environment is so bountiful that these people have developed a kind of like cheerful fatalism. They just expect that things will be provided for them and they don't have the like striving, hardworking attitude that Europeans have. In fact, I saw someone posting about this on Twitter the other day, although he was saying there are like situations where it might be too hot, like to work, too hot to think. And like, that's why the best thinking is done by people from cold countries. Like, I think he was just being naive. And does this account for Great Britain's historical dominance over the rest of the world? And I'm like, Great Britain's historical dominance over the rest of the world was a very limited period of time. The idea that the majority of great, like, philosophers or scientists or whatever come from Great Britain would be risible outside of a particularly narrow window. And for a lot of that time period, where we would say all the great philosophers are coming from, were from places that were notably warm, like Iraq. So this is all stupid. But it is a very common stereotype, and it's used not just in Hawaii, but in lots of places where European colonialists are essentially trying to come up with like a moral justification for why it's okay for them to take over this land. That these people aren't doing anything with it, and they're just enjoying its natural bounty, but it would be so much more productive if we managed it. Now, first off, obviously that argument would be wrong to begin with. You don't have a right to take anybody else's stuff just because they don't happen to be using it in a way that you like. It's none of your business. But even more than that, whether because they didn't know enough about it or because they were being intentionally blind to it, these people are ignoring the fact that these are actually very actively managed landscapes where a lot of hard work has gone into making sure that they are productive. So like, yes, okay, there may be trees full of bananas and what have you everywhere, but somebody worked to make it that way. And a lot of the time, what happens is that people who are coming into a society from outside don't see the things that they recognize as signs of land management, and then they just go, oh, this land is not being managed. But in fact, as we know, land management and land allocation were extremely complex subjects within the society of pre-colonial Hawaii, and people worked very hard to maximize the productivity of assigned lands within different polities. So anyway, this is just a whole bunch of nonsense, and the fact that I saw this, I wrote and deleted two tweets bringing this guy up for being a big ninny about something that, like, if he had thought about it for 10 minutes or less, he would have realized that, like, his premise was fundamentally wrong. But, you know, what's the point? I just scrolled on. Anyway, where was I? The point is that the Menehune are sort of the people to whom are attributed particularly ancient monuments. According to some of the sources I've read, the monuments that are traditionally said to have been built by the Menehune, and I mean here monuments merely in the sense of like archaeological sites, not that that's their sort of like social function, those sites tend to be ones that are very old. So they're places that maybe were created outside of known history or whatever, and then people decided to attribute them to a supernatural agency. That's pretty common in other parts of the world as well. So the details of the Menehune will sound familiar to you, I should think, if, you know, you come from somewhere that has a little people tradition, or if you're familiar with fairy tales at all. Menehune are little human-like creatures. They're sometimes said to have like particularly like poofy hair or like tufts of hair. They stand about 2 feet tall. That's 60 centimeters for my metric listeners, although different sources describe them as different heights, and others say that they're just like people, but they're just short. They're not tiny, but they're just not tall. In some stories, they're said to have intermarried with Hawaiians. And so there are people, humans, who have some Menehune ancestry. These people may be among the people who have the ability to see the Menehune who are normally invisible. Or they're invisible under certain circumstances. It's not really clear. You know, again, the exact nature of their powers varies from story to story. But they certainly seem to avoid human contact. They like to work at night, and they will stop doing their work and run away if someone tries to get a look at them doing it. So there are sort of like half-completed projects, and like, well, yeah, the Menehune started building this, but then, you know, someone got the hubris and decided to try and steal a look at them, etc., etc. In some cases, they turn to stone. I think this is something that Menehune can do or that can be done to them, rather than just like, oh, you know, in sunlight they turn to stone or whatever. But there's certainly kind of stones that are said to be the bodies of Menehune who had tried to like break the rules of their people. And some people seem to be able to summon them. Those may be people who have Menehune ancestry or like who have done a favor for the Menehune or something like that, but that have a connection to them. So for example, there's a legend where a chief has to like complete a certain, I think it's like an irrigation ditch or something like that, but like a public works project basically, within a certain amount of time, and he's not going to get it finished. And his kahuna advises him to summon the Menehune. And it actually says he institutes a particular kapu, but it doesn't say what it is, unfortunately. Or at least Beckwith doesn't repeat what it is. But I like that idea that he sort of puts certain rules in place, and that allows the Menehune to come and complete the project within the like required amount of time. I like this idea that these kinds of large-scale building works are concerns for the ali'i, for the ruling class, because they would be. You know, these sorts of public works projects were a way to demonstrate one's ability to marshal labor and provide for the community, even if it is actually the members of the community who are doing all the work anyway. In addition to buildings and sort of public works things, the Menehune also make canoes. There's an example of a famous canoe which is said to have been left behind by some hero because the Menehune were competing with some other group to build it, and you know, this is the one that didn't get finished in time. The Menehune built him a better one and he sailed away in it. But so yeah, canoe building is another aspect of their thing. Now, a lot of people have attempted to theorize that the Menehune are a legend based on some previous wave of migration to Hawaii. And you will see this in a lot of little people legends. People will write about how, like, the little people in Britain and Ireland, you know, refer to some earlier quote-unquote race of people who inhabited the islands before whatever your chosen group of new migrants is arrived. I mean, whatever. I don't find any of that stuff plausible at all. Not only do I not find it plausible in general, but also my understanding is that the idea that there were two distinct waves of settlement of Hawaii, the first from the Marquesas and the second from Tahiti, is no longer really the consensus among historians of the islands. Although, I speak subject to correction, but that is kind of what I've read, is that this used to be a very common idea, and now people think that the first wave of settlement is actually just legendary. Another debate about the Menehune in modern scholarship is, like, you may have noticed that the Menehune are pretty similar to Brownies or other similar European little people, and some people have suggested that they are, in fact, a European and American addition to Hawaiian folklore, that the similarity between Hawaiian Menehune stories and European stories of Brownies or Kilmuluses or whatever it is because these are simply Hawaiianizations of these existing European stories. And that's hard to deny because we don't have records of what these beliefs were like prior to contact with Europeans, because the recording of them was a result of contact with people from outside of Hawaii. So, I mean, maybe. Or alternatively, they could be an attempt to present a traditional Hawaiian belief in a way that was like filtered through European literature and European preconceptions about what little people's stories would be like. I am not enough of an authority to say which of these I think is plausible. I do think that it would not be too surprising if there were some similarities between European and Hawaiian folklore, given the amount of material that we have already seen that does not exhibit any pronounced similarities. It'd be weird if everything that was being written down by David Malo or whatever was identical to a European belief, but it wouldn't be surprising if amidst a large body of folklore, some of it had similarities to the European things, or that European writers, when writing about the Menehune, focused on those aspects that felt familiar to them. I do think that the modern presentation of the Menehune is filtered through the kind of pop culture version of those folktales. So if you look at depictions of the Menehune in like advertising signs or whatever in Hawaii today, then yes, you would absolutely see that they look a bit like, you know, like the Seven Dwarfs or like the Keebler Elves. You know, they're kind of like comical, Disney-ish sort of depiction is common, and they've become kind of like a symbol of Hawaii, and you know, you can buy Menehune dolls or Menehune t-shirts or whatever. But you know, that just means that this is all part of the same contemporary cultural landscape, which it is. Now, the Menehune aren't the only sort of group of forest people in Hawaiian folklore. Beckwith, for instance, discusses the Nawa'o, or wild people, and they live in the woods and hunt. So they're kind of the opposite of the Menehune. The Menehune are technological. They're, if anything, they're like more civilized than the human Hawaiians with whom they interact. But the Nawa'o are like a contrast to that. And they're also said to be gone, like they went away. It's said that they once existed, but they've now left. And you would think, okay, that is just a convenient excuse for why you hear about them, but you never see any of them. Except that the Nawa'o are said to be the ancestors of two different groups who still exist, the Mu, or silent people, and the Wa, or shouting people. And the Mu in particular, but I think both of them, are sort of considered to be quite dangerous entities. They fall into the category, another very broad category, of Aumakua, which are like ancestral spirits or ancestral gods. Again, remember, those category distinctions are things that don't super apply, or at least not in very clear ways, in Hawaiian mythology. They are outside categories attempting to make sense of something that, you know, has its own rules. But there are examples of kind of like attempting to attract the attention of the Mu in order to make use of their capacity to do harm. I like this idea of summoning them. I think that that's something that should be much more common with the little people in fantasy games in the first place. As I have often said, AD&D is, and its successors, are full of little people of various kinds. Pixies, sprites, gnomes, boggarts, Kilmuluses, Bacons, I mean, you name it. But at least in 5th edition, you never interact with them in a way that feels fairy tale-y. So druids who have the appropriate spell will, like, cast a spell and a portal opens and a bunch of pixies appear, where they just kind of poof into existence. Or alternatively, like, you'll go down to the bar and the bartender will be a Bacon. And there's no difference between him being a Bacon and him being French, right? Like, there's nothing particularly magical about it. I know, my French listeners, I know, you are magical. But you know what I mean. Nobody ever, like, leaves a shiny silver coin on a particular stone to summon the help of the little people, or meets a hungry Bacon by the side of the road and gives him some milk, and then, you know, now he has to do you a favor, or anything like that. So it's weird to have fairy tale creatures, but not in a fairy tale context, I guess is what I'm saying. And we've seen this before, horror monsters, but not in a horror context, all that kind of thing. But I do think that somehow maybe just because the lines between, like, fantasy dungeoneering and horror, like, already there is some overlap in a way that maybe is not true of fairy tales, I don't know, but somehow it's more effective for the horror monsters, I feel. Anyway, my point is that there are rules, you know, there are ways to summon the Menehune. There's that idea that you have to proclaim a particular kapu and then they will come, like, as long as their rules are being followed. And I also like the idea of player characters having, again, maybe being, like, forced by kapu or forced by something else to complete some giant public works project. Oh, you've got to, like, build this wall or, like, set up this how to a particular god, and you have to do it by a certain time. It's just like, well, this is not going to be possible. We need someone to help. Who are the hardest workers in all of Hawaii? It's the Menehune. And I just like the idea of incorporating PC action. You know, this could be a domain game, right? So people always talk about kind of the high level D&D game where you're like running your castle and whatever. I'm currently running one that's like that, but at a lower level, essentially a base and mission style campaign structure where I'm a year behind on listening to, well, actually I'm only about 7 months behind now because I've been catching up, but I was like a year behind on episodes of the Grognard Files just because I stopped commuting so much, and that's when I listen to podcasts. And I've been listening to them talk about Mutant Year Zero, and in their discussion of that, Dirk and Blythe talked about liking the structure of having a base that you return to and then going on missions in between, right? It's the Stargate structure, or the, you know, the Starship Enterprise, where you have a persistent home base with persisting characters, but then a new episodic adventure. And I think that you can kind of like play the domain game during your home base downtimes And I think people like that. I think people like adding stuff to their castle or their village or their whatever and seeing it grow. And then they also like going to a range of different places and interacting with a range of different things and not just defending their place from sieges all the time. And I think the island hopping structure is actually a pretty good way to do that, right? Where you can set out from your island, go to some island where there are monsters, come back. Anyway, if you're engaging with the political aspect, then, as I said, social status can often depend on what you're willing to contribute to the community in terms of construction. If you're going to have that, then the PCs might need the help of the Menehune. Or also, if their village is going to come under attack, right? The Menehune could help you build defenses as long as you're willing to abide by their rules. And what those rules are, I don't know, but we have definitely seen examples of characters in Hawaiian myth coming under kapu that could be quite restrictive and having to go to great lengths to sort of accommodate those kapu. So I like that. So even though they're not like strictly mythological, I think Menehune or Menehune-like characters could have a lot to contribute to a game. And even though in many ways they are similar to European fair folk, I think like little people stories from Europe often have that sense of the twee about them, right? They've been tweeified pretty heavily. Like those stories had or have a quality of whimsy and a quality of strangeness. But I think that the way that they've been presented for a long time really emphasizes the whimsy at the expense of the strangeness. And because they are stories that the majority of my listeners like grew up with, they are kind of comfortingly familiar. Whereas even though they're much the same in their fundamentals, if you say, well, these are Menehune, not brownies, I feel like it just gives them a little bit of distancing, of that form of defamiliarization where you can look at something that you're already familiar with. It helps you see what has always been there in it, but you couldn't perceive it before. That's a thought that might need some further exploration. Goes back to my ancient Rome's weirder than you think, the thing that I'm always talking about, but never mind that for now. I like the Menehune. I'm going to take some stuff from them for the, like, spirits and little people of my D&D game. And I think that they're, you know, they're a pretty promising element. All right, I have no idea what we're going to talk about in our next episode. I think in terms of deities, we're just about done. But I would like to talk a little bit about some monsters from Hawaiian mythology. There's a fun chapter on kind of, like, other monsters in Beckwith, and maybe we can talk about that. And then after that, I think it'll probably be the wrap-up episode. So I know I said it was going to be earlier, but I didn't want to not talk about the Menehune, and I hope that you will join me next time for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.